viewers W.
Preach y'all a sermon about old man Adam. That's me. I don't mean the Adam in the Bible, Adam. I don't mean the Adam that Mother Eve elated. I mean the thing that science liberated. The thing that Einstein says he's scared of. And when Einstein's scared, brother, you'd better be scared. If you're scared of the Adam, here's what you gotta do. You gotta gather all the people in the world with you. Cause if you don't get together and do it, well, first thing you know, I'm going to blow this world plumb, too.
Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Alamogordo, Bikini.
Now,
good morning, Winter Park. This is Punkonomics, and you are listening to WPRK 91.5. And today we have a special guest, and let me introduce you to Joseph Siri, and of course our host, Professor Dr. Benny Balick, and my name is Jesse Velez. And today we're going to touch on a couple topics besides economics and, of course, some of the other taboos. One of them today will be the environment. Anyway, let's say hello to our audience out there in Winter Park.
Hello, hello.
Hello there.
All right, the mics are working.
Yeah, everything seems to be working, except for the environment, which is Dr. Siri's speciality. So just wanted to remind us.
How did you want it to work, though?
Well, not to lead to our imminent extinction, maybe. It's not its fault, right?
Dr. Siri, could you give us a little background about yourself before we start here? Let everybody know that we just don't bring madmen in here, or you know, besides us.
No, I was actually hoping you have to be mad probably to focus on the environment, but it does seem to me that I can tell you a quick story, and that is, I think my first immersion in the environment was growing up in South Florida and getting lost in a mangrove swamp. My family came here from New York, Long Island, and Manhattan, and my father fell in love with Florida. We all hated it growing up. No
sure.
Air conditioning.
No air conditioning.
Mosquitoes. Cockroaches bigger than your fist. You
and know. They fly.
And they fly. And so
unfit for human habitation, basically.
Exactly. So, but I went to the University of California, Santa Barbara, and where else could you study the environment in a better place?
Awesome. I'm from the Bay Area myself.
Oh, see, okay, yeah, terrific. Yeah. So, and it was after the Santa Barbara oil spill, to be fair. And that's actually when environmental studies as a cross-disciplinary subject came into being. And that is because the people in Santa Barbara who saw the oil spill, I think it was Union Oil Company at the time, it was a blowout on one of their rigs, had soaked the beaches. And the birds. And I remember seeing that long before I was educated.
But, right.
Just walking the beach with some friends who took us up there.
Actually, that was a TV commercial that was run for the longest time when that happened, too. And it was very touching, very sad. I do remember that.
Oh, about, you know, the oiled
yeah,
birds.
Yeah, the oiled birds.
Yeah, the sticky birds.
Yeah, the sticky birds. Yeah.
Yeah.
You shouldn't laugh, but, you know, I laugh because when I stop laughing, I start crying.
Exactly.
So. Maybe we should say that Josari is a professor of environmental, officially, what are you?
Environmental studies.
Right, environmental studies. Right. Yes. But you're an environmental economist by
Well, history and economy, the problem with historians is they always have to be faced with this problem, which I always talk to Benny about, which is, so why is the economy, you know, why does the economy every 7 to 11 years, just like droughts, fall from boom to bust?
Right.
And it's something you've got to follow in economic history, of course. And environmental history, I always like to say, is a combination of geography and economics. Through the past.
Right. Because it's dynamic. You see it through a long period of time. So you see these cycles. It's too often, it's too interesting, right? It's too often we're myopic, right? We see a snapshot and we think we understand the world. And historians, and a lot of mathematicians and serious people are trying to figure it out in environmental economics and others, is to see the big picture, see how it changes over time.
Yeah, there's a Frenchman, Braudel, who called it Le Long Durée. You probably can say it better than I can, but...
Long Durée.
Yeah, the Durée, and long that term. Is the notion that we have to have this long-term perspective in order to understand the current kind of blips and things. But but there's been a lot of criticism of late that, especially in education, that all we're dealing with is presentism. All we're teaching people is the last business cycle, if that. And what's really nice about Benny's department is that they've decided that historical perspective on at least since the 18th or 16th centuries is so vital to understanding economics, because economics in light of what the last 10 years is a lot of crap. Oh,
yeah,
I should have said that.
No. Is that marginal? I mean, what about CRAP?
I didn't mean to say that.
That's the organization that you're talking about.
It is the organization. Critical rationalists against pollution.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Yeah. That's a good name. But thanks for the plug. You know, we have our colleagues. Hey, maybe Harry's listening. You know, he's in the office. He made the coffee I just drank.
Was it good?
Our new chair. Hallelujah. Hey, Harry. We are kooks. We're strange radicals in the econ department. We actually like to know what the beep we talk about, and therefore we have to look at what happened before and how we got where we are and not pretend.
Now, you know, most people, they don't understand the environment, but they do understand their pocket. Could you tell some of our folks out there who totally deny that, you know, we're going downhill as far as our environment, how it affects them in their pocket? Because, I mean, that's the bottom line. That's what people look at.
And they may be right. You know, you wake up this morning and you go, oh, my God, the air is fresh. Of course, it's not Newark, New Jersey.
Right.
But you look and say, oh, I turn on the tap water, and it's running relatively clean water that we're drinking in the state of Florida. But cost-wise, I'm sure if everybody looks at either their energy bill or their water bill, at least in where we are in Seminole County, those rates have gone up. And you could argue, well, what's that got to do with the environment? Well, without water, there's no electricity, and without electricity, there's no water. The people in New Jersey and Long Island and Staten Island discovered that. We did too when we had the three hurricanes.
Know, right?
When you don't have electricity, you can't pump gas.
Right.
Well, you can't pump water either, because that comes from the ground. It's not like Switzerland where it's falling off a mountain into your house. So in some ways, the direct is water, power, electricity, those kinds of things. But I would argue that this is why I'm glad Benny and I are talking, because the question is, was this an economic collapse that we experienced in 2008, right off the dot-com collapse in 1998 or 1999? Or, as a speaker here said some years ago, part of this housing boom that we've experienced is underwritten by what environmentalists would say is cheap water. Water in the West, Arizona, Nevada, I understand, were really big areas for foreclosures, but they were growing rapidly. And why were they growing rapidly? They're in a desert. Well, there's federal water projects that bring very cheap water to these areas, and you, without water, you don't develop. You don't suburbanly develop without cars and electricity, but you certainly don't develop without water.
It falls actually into stuff that we've raised before, at least I don't want to impinge on others, that I'm kind of borderline, beyond border, most would say, conspiracy theorist at this point. It's just that I'm right about these you know? But this is an economic situation in which certain companies, individuals, well-connected, powerful politically individuals are taking, are scrounging, frauding the general public in the sense that in this example they can make a lot of profit off of these developments that are unsustainable. They push off costs onto the general public, like destroying the water in the region, building too much where there's not enough environment possibility, and it can't be sustained. They make their profit, they sell the house. The trouble comes, they don't have to pay for it. Now, when you have economic operation under a market system, under capitalism, in which somebody is not paying for the full costs, then for those of you who had to suffer through economics, you know, that means you're not measuring it right, right? The demand and the supply are not where they really are. So that whatever equilibrium, the invisible hand of Adam Smith is not operating. It's not getting you to the right quantities, the right prices, that amazing thing that the market does. Is simply not working. We call it a market failure. And used to be, when I was undergrad a while ago, it was we were arguing, yeah, there's market failure out there, the mainstream economic. Now it's an argument about how much, you know.
How much is the market?
Are there any, or how many? Are there any markets that aren't failing in some sense? And a lot of these things, whether it's political corruption and interest groups that are influencing to their specific needs and interests that can be conflicting with the rest of the population, all that stuff. It's not about opinion, ideology. It's gung-ho free market. This ain't it. You know, you don't have to criticize the markets for this. You have to see that they're not working. Don't get me wrong, I'm not apologetic here. Some people criticize the markets, and I listen to them, you know. There's some issues with markets. Like maybe this unsustainability, right? That we just have to grow to survive, like a shark, right? That has to swim to stay alive, otherwise they suffocate. Is this...
Personally, and here's something that I want to ask you. When I came back to Florida, I lived here back in the early 80s, but not for not aging myself. When I got off the aircraft, I mean, back then, Orlando Airport was basically like a bus stop. Literally.
That's right.
like a bus stop. But one thing that really hit me was the pine trees. I mean, everywhere you looked around, it was all wall-to-wall pine trees, and that smell, and the air was really cool and crisp, sort of like what you see up north, I mean, but with a little humidity, of course. I was fascinated by that. It's one of the, you know, like your folks with the mangroves and all that. That's the one thing that attracted me to Central Florida.
Trees are beautiful here. Let's give it what it deserves.
Yeah, well.
No healthcare.
When I left for California and living out there for the longest time, I noticed that the construction, okay, now in California, for you to be able to do what they do here, which is literally bulldoze a whole section of land, trees and everything, it seems to me that part of the problem with the environment and the economics, okay, they're both intertwined, is that they have a bad design. In California, what we do is we build around the environment, pretty much. Here, we just completely clean it off. And even to go further, a prime example is my home. I had a home built out there in Waterford Lakes. It's supposed to be a nice whatever. But the laws here enable a construction company to go ahead and use whatever land, whatever debris, cinder blocks, and, you know, iron and whatever, trash, mm-hmm. and use it as a landfill. And that really struck me because I came back, I basically rented my house out because I was flying for the airline, so I couldn't be here all the time. But I was taking care of my folks, so I'd come in occasionally. When I decided to move to Florida, being from California, I was missing my trees, you know, I'm going like, okay, let me go out to Home Depot and get all these trees. Mm-hmm. It was taking me an average of 3.5 hours to dig one, no, I'm serious, to dig a four-foot mm-hmm. hole to plant one tree. And every time I dug, I pull out a cinder block, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, McDonald's packages, I mean, every single thing you can possibly imagine. And my house is right next to an aqueduct. So I'm thinking, are these people crazy? You know, this will not go in California. Well, of course, me being the angry unemployed flight attendant, which is the last person anybody wants to get upset.
Yeah.
And you can ask VA that.
It's like worse than postal, right?
Yeah, exactly. Worse than postal.
The meme, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well,
going flight attendant.
So I got proactive and decided, okay, the environmental agency. First people where I went, like, okay, my government.
Uh-oh.
Well, yes, exactly. Exactly. It took me almost a whole day to find where this entity was. They're in some little office in Orlando, probably with no sign on it. Finally, they didn't know about what was the law that would actually cover about putting all this pollutants into my backyard. So I had to wind up calling Atlanta, Georgia. They said to me, well, you know, back in 1999, matter of fact.
When your house was built?
When the not when my house was built. Okay. I guess the laws here changed. They decided they were going to allow construction companies to go ahead and use whatever they want as a landfill. And there's nothing you can do, but that's I'm going like, okay, well, I'm living right next to an aqueduct. If they used mercury or something, and I mean, it should be dripping into the water supply. So it seems to me that between not having a design to work around the environment and having all these flimsy laws, you're basically killing yourself economically, because later on they're going to have to treat that water. They're going to have to maybe even dig out all the trash
and
put in my backyard.
But the people that pulled
cost cutters.
and thus made better profit upon doing that instead of doing it in a sound way, don't pay for that cost. Who pays for that cost? Maybe the city, and then it's public money directly, or maybe just in the disease rates, cancer rates, those of us drinking the McNugget juice and our babies, etc., and the long-term health. Somebody's gonna pay for the cost. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, didn't you tell me the other day when we had a couple of pints about the study that measured the value of the services that the general environment?
Well, you mentioned market failures, and what you're talking about is something that has for a long time in environmental studies has been called commonizing costs and privatizing profits.
Okay.
And if you're a rational businessman, you're trying to push your costs off to anybody. Your people, and if you're a joint stock company, to your investors. So when Ben mentioned this to me, I said, well, both the market failures as well as the tendency among libertarians, for instance, to treat the environment, but even Marxists, as a free good.
Okay.
And that's kind of what you're dealing with. Well, it's free. I can dump my my waste material wherever I want to be able to dump it. Does it matter if it's going to pollute an aquifer? That's one example of a market failure, because as you said, somebody's got to pay for it eventually. The other example is that, well, so how much is the land, whatever was there before, let's say you were in a pine forest, or better, we'll talk about it in La Popka wetland soon as an example. Whatever was there before, was it worth anything? And of course, in a housing boom, no, it's not. Just cut it all down. But a guy by the name of Costanza came up with an attempt to rationally figure out how much natural capital is accumulated by the amount of sunlight and the amount of water and the amount of vegetation in an area. In places like California, vegetation on hillsides is pretty important because it stops the hillside from landing in your living room.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. In Florida, unless a flood comes, or you're living on a beach and a wave comes, you don't recognize the land as valuable to you because it stops flooding, or the vegetation holds the land. And so one good example, I think, of this is that Costanza tried to figure all this out, and this is $1990, I think, although I don't know how big inflation has been since the 90s because of the collapse, but $33 trillion a year is one estimate. I'd like to see the current estimates, but every year, the amount of sunlight, the amount of water that's pumped up from the oceans and falls as fresh water and rain over the land, the amount of soil bacteria, if you can even estimate that sort of thing, but there's carbon in the soil, all of that contributes to what we would call natural capital. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like your bank account, and every year, $33 trillion is put into it. That is the cost of replacement. A better example for your listeners who come from New York would be, New York City doesn't treat its water because it gets its water from natural reservoirs in the Catskills. They do run an aqueduct all the way down.
Famous.
And so they're they keep the watershed around the Catskills as nearly empty of development. It's farms and cattle and grazing areas and woodlands and recreational areas. And somebody's estimated it'd be $5 billion to replace that, just to provide water for the city of New York alone, if they had to figure out a way to replace the natural, we call it watershed.
Yeah, remember, for the viewers, I mean, this is like, you know, the earth is a machine, you know, all of those things providing. If we destroy our beaches, we'll have to build some concrete walls, right?
Or right.
Storm the, how much would that cost? You know,
it's
what
like
is the natural environment farm. Serving us economically? Right. What's it worth to us directly economically? So it's not about hugging Mother Nature or anything like that. It's about direct value.
And you can sort of see it in these floodings and the deaths, actually, in Staten Island and Rockaway Beach and in parts of New Jersey with the storm. If you get rid of your dune system along the beach, or you get rid of your wetlands, which absorb water during a flood, it's going to go in your basement. Of course, why do you have a basement below sea level is another question of development. That's just what you were talking about mm-hmm. before, is dumb design,
right,
which has been criticized by some people in California for over 20 years. Dumb design is when you put yourself in harm's way, then you go to the government and say, wait a minute, will you give me my house back? Because I either built on a slope that was too steep,
right,
or I put it in a wetland, or in the case of the discovery of a woman in upstate New York, you may remember this, same situation. Hooker Chemical had buried not just building materials, but in a canal,
right,
in Love Canal, had buried pretty toxic materials. Well, they went bankrupt. But they sold this to people into the notion of affordable housing,
mm-hmm,
these cheap mortgages on places. In Love Canal, the mothers in the area noticed their children playing on seeping chemical playgrounds, you might say. And so the children, the cost of this was borne by children who mm-hmm. end up, as you know, they grow faster than the rest of us, and they're absorbing these chemicals
faster
in
right.
ways. So Love Canal had convinced a typical American housewife, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with being a housewife. Some of my best friends are housewives, but
it's my career goal.
A person who had no intention of ever being an environmental activist, had no intention of ever working outside the home, because work inside the home is work enough, which is a good example of market failures, right?
Absolutely.
The work in the home is never considered
just
to be
a third
part of the
unpaid of entire activity in
exactly.
the developed world.
Right.
Is
or
like,
taking care of another way, taking care of a person who's sick. And why are they sick? Well, maybe they were exposed to something.
I mean, we don't value the environment. We don't even value our family. We value very little. It's very important that people realize, because like you say, I mean, it's easy for who knows this stuff. A lot of people don't realize, you know.
Right.
I chose, for example, not to live, my wife was the one to take care of it, really, not to live in Baldwin Park, because I was drafted into a certain military. We'll maybe talk about that another show.
Oh, it's built on an old military base. Yeah.
After
that's right.
tens of years of I spent 3 years on a military base. I dumped, not to use again, not to get us enough into trouble
yeah,
with
no,
our
no,
evil
no,
guest here.
I'm sorry about that.
Batteries, my God, lithium battery. You know, where do you put it, sir? Dump it somewhere, you know? I know how procurement works, you know? I'm not living there and with 1 foot of earth between
right,
me
right.
and 70
right.
years of God knows what.
Well, critical rationalists against pollution, I just was going to say, is that Lois Gibbs was this person who worked at home. And she became an environment, she created a council for health and environmental justice. And she did that because she realized, she was the one who got Jimmy Carter to recognize that there's something wrong in Love Canal. And that's the greatest externality, if you want to call it yeah. that, or market failure, that we allow the burial of even toxic materials
mm-hmm.
In places that people will eventually be the ones to pay.
And naturally,
with their health.
Who?
Because of this.
Poor people, minority, they're horrible.
Working class,
an opportunity
yeah.
to remind about the Koch brothers, you know, who kill many people, preferably poor black people, that's in Georgia and where there are other
mm-hmm.
places, by buying politicians to allow them to outright poison the water that flows into people's communities. Again, if it was rich people, they wouldn't let it happen, I understand, you know.
Or you desalinate the water. San Diego apparently is going to desalinate
just
the water.
Right,
did you,
right,
I don't
right.
know if you Canada because they can afford to, number one, but it's among the most expensive things you can do. The Saudis do it, but of course they've got a little bit of oil there.
Yeah, it's extremely energy, energy intensive, right? So it's one of the problems that it's so expensive to do, so in specific locations. But then what are you going to do? I mean, Arizona, basically Phoenix needs to be canceled.
About the only thing they can give us is solar energy, maybe geothermal.
But they don't have enough water. But
they have no water.
You could trade, I suppose, but there's not really enough.
Well, I'm glad you actually brought that up because
sounds
here's
like,
something.
Sounds like a North and South California discussion.
Let's trade the water.
You want the what's striking is that there are forms of electricity, making electricity that don't use a lot of water. Geothermal can be one of those, although it has some water. But we'd go to great extent to drill for oil and strip mine for coal and remove mountaintops and affect water supplies. But no one ever counts that. You were talking about the accounting that doesn't get into the equation that we call the market or the invisible hand. And the biggest invisible hand is mountaintop removal. In West Virginia and Kentucky and Pennsylvania, these people whose eventual water supplies, fracking has become the
I was just getting ready to ask you about that, your opinion on that.
Yeah, anybody owns property in Pennsylvania? Sell.
Come south.
Yeah, given that the President Obama has basically decided to outdo his opponent in terms of independent oil, and it sounds great. Yeah, we're going to be oil independent, but at what cost? It's just like the whole pipeline XL thing and the tar sands and all that. I mean, if you count the damage, the amount of oil that needs to get a lot of oil to get a little oil out.
That's right.
But of course, when you ship it through the pipe to specific buddies of yours who run refineries in Texas, they're going to make a killing. Overall, the whole issue of you know, the tar sand and the XL and all that stuff that was so hyped up is putting a hell of a lot of energy to get a little bit out. Few people get rich in the process, and everybody else gets left with the bill. Business as usual.
And that's what ethanol is, made from corn. It takes more energy to get the energy out of the ethanol that we're using for gasoline additive.
You know, that's why anybody even considering doing more drilling should go and check out Texas, where pretty much everywhere you look around, all you see is just these big...
never mind. That has
actually Long Beach.
Aesthetic.
I lived in Long Beach,
Southern California.
For a year, I kept wondering, you know, why do they have this? Or, you know, supposed to be to the environment, all this kind of
Signal
stuff.
Signal Hill.
It's amazing, but
that's nothing next to fracking. I mean, if we need pumps and stuff, you know, a lot of people now in Europe, since they have all of those huge windmills going up, there's a lot of people are against it. It's not pretty. First of all, I like to say, shut up, you know, this is what not going extinct look like, you know.
But birds, though, as I say. Birds don't know enough not to fly into those big propellers.
I don't know, the airline, we used to suck in quite a few of them in the engines.
I wondered about that. I should ask you about the birds and
but those are, and the aesthetic costs are real costs. I'm not saying no, but a lot of what's going on now with fracking is pretty scary.
Well, what about mountaintop removal as far as aesthetics go? You never hear anybody say, oh, but they just took the top of a West Virginia mountain off.
And
that used to be aesthetic, but as you said, we discount it when we want to for Peabody Coal Company, but we don't necessarily discount it for... I don't know, Johnny Tremaine and his windmills in Vermont or something.
As historians, we kind of, precisely to the point you started with, we kind of see that and we go, oh my God, we're basically beginning to do here domestically in America what we did in the Third World for centuries, you know, stripping it clean with no, you know, extracting its value and spitting out, the empty husk. We're starting with the poor in America.
Well, some people have said that about Louisiana. If you look at the history of Louisiana... It's very much like the history of a colonial place, right? All of that energy that comes from Louisiana is piped to the Northeast or to Chicago, out of Louisiana. And places like Florida spend billions of dollars a year just to get oil and natural gas into the state. When, to go back to that geothermal as opposed to fracking or mountaintop removal, MIT did a study that geothermal, both in the sense of making electricity from it or just using it as heat pump, passive designs could actually supply considerable amounts of power, electrical power, and cut down on heating and cooling needs in the United States. So where's the government pushing geothermal?
No, I mean, these things are like no-brainers, too. I mean, I remember what shocked me tremendously coming to Florida. I was like, what? No solar energy?
No solar
energy. I mean, I lived in the Third World, and, you know,
in sunny places, they have it. It's not nothing high tech. Like,
well,
you know,
in Israel, you have to have a hot water heater. I was told.
Everybody,
when we were
you're
there.
Insane. Yeah. I mean, it's standard, and it's just like basic. It's like the pool type. It's not like the fancy electric or anything like that. It's just that there's enough sun all the time, it's and the water circulates on the roof.
Right.
And
right.
Collect. Maybe it's not pretty, you know, the rooftops.
The rooftops.
You know, not very. But again, it's what survival
sure.
looks like. Yeah.
Well, rooftops. I'm glad you mentioned, because you know you mentioned for your listeners what's really simple. In Florida, we air conditioning mostly in homes. Mm. Our attics.
Right.
Because mm-hmm. all the ductwork is in the attic, okay? The temperature in your attic, I bet, in the summer is 150 degrees, right? Of course, you're trying
incredible.
To get it to be, mm-hmm. what, 70 degrees in maybe, yeah. or 60 degrees in your living area?
Sure.
Well, but your ductwork is moving through. Sure.
Through all this heat, right.
All this heat.
Yeah, I actually just finished repairing my dad's duct, and it's like, yeah, that's a nasty work.
We
yeah.
foamed, actually. We foamed our roof.
You foamed?
It cost a
yeah.
lot of money, though.
Right. But then people will have dark roofs because it's aesthetically interesting. Well, that's going to be absorb more heat than if you had a white roof. The interesting thing is Florida 30, 40, 50 years ago had two things that you could see on some roofs. One is the old white Bermuda mm-hmm. or Bahama tiling.
Right.
Even the barrel tile was white. Like here at Rollins, we have all this crazy red tile. It mm-hmm. just absorbs a great deal of heat, no matter which foam you put on it.
But it's oh so Spanish cologne.
It's so Spanish.
Right, exactly.
faux Spanish cologne. So we claim that's aesthetics, but why
it's
is
Disneyfication.
Why do the Bahamians have white, or why do the Greek islands
yeah,
have
sure.
white on their buildings? That's one simple issue.
Yeah, you whitewash the roofs once a year. It's like kids. Actually, what a flashback. I haven't thought about this for 30 years. You know, one of those things like in America, your neighbor's kid with that. So yeah, in Israel, your neighbor's kid, probably not anymore today, but in my day, once a year, everybody could just whitewash the roof. It'd be, you know, tar, but then you whitewash it to keep it nice and white, which has a big impact.
Yeah, it reflects a lot of that heat off. But so as you start paying for this electricity, and that's the worst thing you can do with electricity is use it to heat or cool air, because it just takes more, and water would be worse if you're using electricity to heat your water. But Florida, you'd assume, in the 1890s was more ahead than we were in the 1990s, because Florida in the 1890s had solar hot water heaters, and they came pretty standard. It's like Israel today, right? Mm-hmm. I was told.
I'm guessing I haven't been there since.
Oh, you haven't been there? No. We just came back from Israel a few years ago, and people we met there, both friends and non-friends, said, yeah, you can't build a building in Israel without a solar hot water heater.
And that's like cheap. It's nothing. I mean, it's just a metal, you know, put your big thing. Well, what is it called? The container for the mm-hmm. hot water, right? Put it on the roof. Have this kind of just a tubing in black plastic.
They have it throughout Greece. They have it throughout Turkey.
Now think if they done that here, all the jobs they would have produced just out of that.
Yeah.
I mean.
Well, there's the big lie, you and Benny wanted me to address this too, that there's always this argument that the environment, what's good for the environment is bad for the economy, jobs, and
sure.
vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And yours is a great example. I wrote both the president and the governor, when we had a decent governor, Charlie Crist, and I think he saw the point. You can hire not only local engineers, not only do you need day laborers, in a sense, to put this stuff up mm-hmm. on the roof, but you need sort of technicians in between
right.
that have to understand how to put things together in these solar hot water heaters, let alone solar
maintain.
Electric, and maintain them. So you end up employing not only people, but a range of specialty. And I would think no better jobs creator for Florida would be putting a solar electric or solar hot water heater on every government building in Florida. And nobody needs to have to pass anything for that. A governor could say, I want all my buildings to be energy efficient.
Right.
And the federal government, the GSA, could just create a standard that says federal buildings in areas that have sunlight on these many days should all have solar collectors, mm-hmm. either for hot water, but better electricity. But you can help us with this, Benny. Wouldn't that create where they say, oh, there's no market for solar? Or the price is such because the market isn't there for solar.
Yeah, it's one of those arguments. I mean, and again, I don't think in our day it maybe sounds left-wing, but that's because it's crazy times.
this is not a really a government intervention element. It's true that to create the commissar of hot showers by sun, you know, and having government officials go on your roof and mess around, I'm against it myself. That probably wouldn't be efficient. But to nudge, to give a little extra incentive, do this. There's profit in it. It might be risky for private industry. The first mover may have advantages, but also disadvantages. You know, they'll have expensive equipment. The next guy will come along and kill them, having learned from them and enjoyed their experience.
Right.
So give them a little nudge in the right direction. Don't regulate business. Empower it a little bit. There is room for private profit out of this, but there are often cases where we're kind of stuck. Nobody's stepping. No, the private sector isn't stepping, and it's everywhere. Again, it's one of these issues. High speed rail. You know, it's a great example. The French high speed rail, right?
Lots of jobs.
Over 15 years of debt. It's so expensive. No private company would ever develop high-speed rail system. The infrastructure,
even in France,
No way. It's the same thing in France. Again, another capitalist country. Americans don't realize just how capitalist. In some ways, more capitalist than America, because anyway. But after 15 or 17 years of debt, it starts making a lot of money now because it just makes so much sense. People are paying. It costs as much as flying, but more convenient many cases, etc. And it's pretty cool to be in a train at like 300 miles per hour.
Well, the TGV.
Not the record breaking. They're like there's one line that you're actually it's amazing.
Right. Well, you can wake up in Berlin, and you can be in Frankfurt, and still have a business day. And that's the other side of Germany, which is about the size of France.
Some people say, it's more like East Coast. In America, it's a little bit, it's so big, so it's a little bit more complicated. But certainly it's true that we have abysmal. Another thing that was a shock to me as a kind of a person coming from abroad, admiring America, seeing it on TV, you know, being a tourist here once or twice before moving here almost 20 years ago, was the infrastructure. I was like, oh my God, this reminds me of the Middle East in the 70s. What is these roads?
It has not changed.
What are these
roads?
I'm living in Winter Park in the middle class side, where the help lives next to Cimarron.
Just to be clear. Almost in the bubble, right?
Yeah, just at the border there where we tolerate the,
enough to be enticed into the bubble.
Tolerated, right? On the wrong side of Katyway. But the electric system. These little like rotten wooden sticks with like dangling wires. I haven't seen this since I guess when I was fortunate enough to visit Africa a few years back. I got to tell Americans, this is like embarrassing.
And why does the power go out so much in Central Florida?
Yeah, I kind of wondered about that too.
I've never noticed that in California. I never noticed it in Miami with Florida Power and Light. But in Central Florida, the power goes
all
out
all the time,
even on campus.
And the quality of it, by the way. I mean, I'm a big geek, video gamer, I got gaming rigs, water cooled and stuff, liquid cooled. I need to condition my electricity. I have a rather expensive, like $600, power supply. And it's not really so much about the backup, though. That's very helpful because you don't want, in the power. But it's also the quality of the electricity. It's noisy. It's third world. I'm not trying to be
sure. So it can ruin your equipment, is what you're for the reader.
So in the big picture, it's indicative of the fact that we're not investing in this, and now we must. This is not. What a crazy world are we in? We're saying that we must maintain and upgrade and modernize our infrastructure because it's upon it. Just like the planet, right? And upon the planet, we put our infrastructures. And this is the machine on which we live. This is the base machine.
Well, someone said our fiber optics, that we're like 29th in the world.
That's optics. A pain as a geek.
And for us in America, who thought that we invented the transistor and the microchip. And so why not the delivery system? Why not have the best delivery system? Apparently, I guess the Japanese and even parts of China, Shanghai, I imagine, have more fiber.
Korea is the world champion.
Korea the champion in this.
But everything, even roads, basic things like that, right? Let alone the schooling system. This was the stuff that was put together that came because and enabled at the same time the market system in the early days of industrialization. Now we're allowing it to rot. Well, what do you think is going to happen? And that's, again, that is one of the main processes, like the blood system of a capitalist system. Yet now to say, my God, don't cut the budget, don't bail out the banks, put the money in green energy, green jobs, reinvigorating and reconstructing. Our bridges are falling apart. Our electrical system is 1950s. It's an embarrassment. That is core capitalism. That's not anti-capitalist. Yet in the rhetoric and the propaganda, in the public sphere, this has become like an extreme left of the Democratic Party or something. So it's really tragic. Irrational.
Why it doesn't make any sense, and especially because we live in a culture that's obsessed with technology.
Yeah.
And it, you know, from my personal experience, it's basically flying to different countries. It always amazed me that all the new technology was basically old technology at these places that I went to, but it was like prehistoric when you compare it to what we have here. You know, mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense that we've pretty much just keep falling behind when we've actually, you know, built some of this technology and just gave it to somebody else. You know, it doesn't make any sense to me. Where all that money is going?
It's political economy. You know, I mean, there's no, why bother? When instead of making cleaner power companies, that costs a lot of money. You know, politicians go for what? Between 10,000 to 40,000 a term. It's the cheapest good you can buy. I mean, specifically.
Oh, the politician is the cheapest.
Yeah, the Koch brothers spread like $80,000, $100,000. I mean, it's nothing. I mean, it's their Twinkie budget, probably. You know, I mean, this we're talking billionaires.
$2 billion for the presidential campaigns, at least. Each
one of them?
Each one of them spent $1 billion.
The Koch brothers specifically?
No, I was just thinking Obama's people a billion and then Romney's people
$1 billion.
Nothing. What could
compared
you do
to the corporate profits? I mean, look, hey, how about BP? What kind of damage did they cause? What, $4 billion they get away with? I remember Obama saying that they will be held accountable, and I remember, you know, shrugging and, you know, and coughing and saying,
yeah, 11
right.
people were killed on that rig when it blew up, I thought. Yeah, mm-hmm. So
like that,
there's that alone, what are 11 lives worth? But to destroy the fishery economy of the Gulf, I probably think they spend more money on the advertisements. You see those?
Absolutely.
We're cleaning up, go back to the Gulf. It's just as great as it used to be.
Exactly.
Don't eat the oysters.
You know, I lived in Puerto Rico in the 70s, and we had a big oil spill in the bay. And I remember seeing all this black stuff just coming up to the beaches and stuff. And then it was, who was it? It may have been Gulf. One of those oil companies. And so they gave some money to the government. They sort of cleaned it out a little bit. Years and years and years, you know, still to today, you will find.
And
that was back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can imagine what's happening in the Gulf right now and what they haven't told us. Because, you know, all those reports don't really come out. I mean, they give you the big picture, but not the fine details, which really winds up killing
you. Yeah, it was a pleasure, actually. The whole BP spill affair is, I think, the first time I taught my propaganda class. It was a beauty. Here's the science. Here's what you're hearing. And, you know, it was such a theater of, at some point, literally the government was supporting the Coast Guard. I'm not sure exactly where. Okay, it's been a while, and my brain is addled. But a lot of environmental scientists were coming out from California and other places, kind of on boats, getting boats from people. Let's measure, let's do quick, and they were blocked. We don't want no experts sniffing around here. We got it all under
That's
control.
Right.
Thank you. Oh, it's not too bad, you know. Talk to the marketing gentleman over there. My God, I'd send the Coast Guard, but in different order.
But you know, in all reality, the American public is just really used to being told things in a sugar-coated type situation. When you come out and say something really blunt, it's almost like they don't want to believe it. You know, it's total denial. And I think that a lot of it basically affects the way we do business and the way we treat the environment here, is that unless it's really affecting you, unless you have like a mountain slide on you because you build, you know, just as you were saying.
Colorado fires, for instance.
All of a sudden you drink your tap water and you, you know, need to go to the hospital.
Fire
because,
like in Pennsylvania.
Right, exactly. Then that's when people all of a sudden go, oh, well, what happened? And they get really angry. Right. By that point, it's pretty much almost too late. I mean, all they can do is just kind of like try to...
Right. Or why can't I build my house back in Far Rockaway? Because it just, a wave just came and washed it away. And I guess New York City is saying now that there's certain areas they don't want to see houses put back on. If we look at a larger issue of just flooding in general, we should encourage somehow people moving. Now, whether you're not you subsidize that is another issue, but a good clearer example for most of your listeners, probably. I was shocked. Luckily, in Seminole County, we have a sewer system. We connect to sewer.
The bedrock of civilization.
We just end up polluting the St. John's River via the Iron Bridge wetlands. But what shocks me around people living around Lake Maitland, for instance, I'll say Lake Maitland because maybe beyond your listening range.
I actually do get that. And I lived there for a little bit, so I know what you're talking about.
But you look and you say to yourself, we discovered in trying to buy a house in that area that, they're on septic. Septic tanks. Septic tanks in Florida are like everywhere. Burying things in the backyard. Mm-hmm. And
gross, if you ask me.
And the argument is, well, it's going to cost $5,000 to $10,000 to take a person off septic and put them on sewage. Well, the state needs to create a fund, clearly, to be able to help that process.
Right.
Or include it in a mortgage in new sales or something. But when things have never been affordable in the past, didn't we create mortgages so that people could afford houses? So. But why the septic as opposed to connecting to sewer, or why a solar hot water heater is not part of the mortgage, or why you don't have solar mortgages? They were trying this, I thought, with Bank of America in Colorado for a while.
I looked into actually doing some of these, solar electricity. I didn't even know that exists.
I wondered,
is there any encouragement? That must have been what, three?
None.
You have to be like really rich to do environment, you know, individual environmental, and that's maybe a big economic point too, that a lot of things, you just like big corporations will not develop futuristic, cool technology for us when it's too expensive without a nudge in the direction that, come on, do that research, we'll protect you, start the ball rolling, and then the free markets can, in often cases, take charge.
But if you can afford a souped-up Mercedes, I mean, if you can afford a $100,000 car, you can make your entire home.
Sadly, I'm not in that
solar electric.
Solar electric.
Yeah, we don't make
bracket,
that. We don't make that here at Rollins.
Exactly, but it was a couple of tens of thousands of dollars extra, which I didn't have to, and especially since electricity, we're not paying the full price of it, right?
I should ask you this, Benny, because of your economics background, and that is, I finally contacted the Grameen Bank people. There's four Grameen banks. And I guess what we're getting at is, why don't we enable the people who are in the working class and below an ability to do something, invest, buy something, make money, and then pay back the loan? And Grameen Bank, as you know, does this. There's four of them in the country. And they said to me, I think you need between $3 million or $6 million capital to create one of these. Okay, there's one in Ohio, there's one in Iowa, there's one in Oakland, California, and I believe there's one in New York City to make small micro loans. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I said to myself, $6 million, that's not much, in a way.
No.
But and we might be able to just go around to enough banks and large investors in Central Florida and say, why don't we create a Grameen Bank? And I think it goes to your point. We're not making loans to the sector of the economy, or maybe I'm wrong, that could actually benefit from small.
Yeah, but we
loans.
Don't want to. They're not important. They don't pay for our campaigns. Okay. You know, these are poor people. Did you even hear the P word anywhere during the campaign?
It's a dirty word.
Middle class.
You don't hear working class.
Never.
Hear.
Working class.
Oh, that's over.
Not
I haven't
the
heard
poor.
That in a long time.
50 million Americans are dirt poor. You know, dirt poor. In the campaign, Obama... nothing. Never said the P word. And it was, by the way, significantly criticized for it, by Cornel West, most famously, quite justifiably. I'd say that's the politics. You know, we could solve most of our problems rationally, mostly using, overall market-oriented systems. You know, we don't even need some kind of a dramatic revolution in many cases. But we're not serving these people. We're serving the people who are destroying the planet, setting the world on fire for profit, who claim they care about the rest of us. But frankly, you know, I wouldn't count on it unless you feel comfortable with being like a feudal peasant and master likes me.
Well, they advertise they like us. They advertise that they're doing things for... Did you notice that the railroads now advertise that, we move all of this freight and look at how much carbon we don't put into the air? And I felt like saying... you're really just transporting what you've transported for the last 150 years. You're a railroad, for God's sakes. But they're trying to tell us that they're taking all of this freight off of the highways and therefore saving all this gasoline. And I feel like saying, I don't think railroads were invented to save gasoline. But if you want to advertise that way.
Though shipping and doing more railroads would be good. An excellent idea.
It is.
But the thing is,
but they're not environmental, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
They weren't created to save the environment.
Little improvements are not good enough. So you're talking about microcredit for poor people in America. You know, my answer was that I don't think the politicians are interested in this, you know, because they're not paying, you know, who cares. A lot of these little solutions are good. The Occupy movement now is, you know, just invested in this operation
at
small scale where they put a few millions of dollars and they're bailing out people. They're buying, you know, cheap defaulted
housing loans
underwater and tearing it up. You know, they're buying people's debts off. It's barely a drop in the bucket, though. And then I just heard my favorite podcaster, I got to say, you know, and go to our if you want, maybe, right? Because I can't tell you what to do. It's against FCC regulations. Go to Facebook, to our Punkonomics page, and see that Punkonomics likes Doug Henwood, a wonderful analyst. He kind of criticized it and got a little flack recently, but his criticism was, this is great, you know, but it's not solving the problem.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. So our problems are too big. We must have a guiding hand in some sense. That's why we need a functioning democracy. It's impossible to solve our problems individually by, I'll just find some money and put a solar panel on my roof and I recycle my bottles.
It's really hard to pass that message because about it. The moment you turn on the TV, what do you see? It's rich people driving these amazing cars, you know, living in large homes, but you never really see commercials unless maybe once in a full moon where they show a poor person trying to, you know, farm or do something and, you know, showing in the background the environment, how it affects them or anything like that.
No, dude, you never see poor people on TV unless they're being molested by police for the entertainment of the public.
It's like what I was saying.
Since Roseanne Barr, we haven't seen any working class.
Right, so, yeah. That's just it. Unless it affects, you know, the person directly, they won't take any action. I mean, the moment somebody, when I was walking out of here one night, was saying, no, we... You know, let's hope Mitt Romney wins because, you know, and the way it was said, I guess they were just trying to pull my coattail or something like that. And I turned around and I looked at them and I said, well, you know, that's fine. You know, I live in a nice neighborhood. I'm sure you live in a nice neighborhood too. But, you know, it can go the other way around. The people that live in the poor neighborhoods can also decide they want to come to our neighborhood and not ask, but take.
Eventually,
history
teaches us that happens. You know, the poor always eat. You know what? Sadly, you know, I'm not an idealist. I'm not looking for some utopia where there's no more poverty. I mean, that's a goal. You know, it's like the Holy Grail in Christianity, right?
It used to be a bipartisan goal in the United States.
Right.
That's the shock.
But now there's a bipartisan goal too. We don't give a hoot.
Right.
The bipartisan agreement. Right. So because I have it, Jesse, as regular listeners know, has this Obama, tendency. And I'm willing to go with him to some point, just because the other guy was such an obvious nutter. But still, let us remember, you know, that the poor don't get zilch from the president.
I give the president hell too, you know. But I have to be nice to him now because.
Your mortgage? No.
I want to give a special thanks to Judge Martin of Veterans Affairs nice big grin to the board of BVA. Guess what, guys? 85. 85.
Let me just say that Jesse's finished with a big fight for his veteran dad because that's
very
another,
good.
You know, we should have a show just
you
on
should.
That. I'm how very. The veterans come back from war in America and they are being
ignored.
Ignored. Okay, because I was looking for a polite word. It's not really the best word here, ignored, but let's use that for now.
And obstacles are put in their way.
So they fight, you know, and then they come back here, and let alone that they probably don't have a house, they don't have health care, and
some
then
don't
they
have
never
jobs,
don't have jobs, they don't have money. You know, I mean, more of them kill themselves now than die in wars.
Right.
Yet
right.
How many cars have these purple? I'm sorry, yellow.
Right,
support
right,
the troops.
Right,
well, I guess you only support them until they get back here.
Yeah. Right, and then they're forgotten, completely forgotten. But you know, the key thing, and this for everything in life, is persistent. When you have nothing to lose, Why not?
You're an example of it. I wanted to leave your listeners with this, the issue that we brought up with bipartisan, because I know we're out of time, mm-hmm. and that is, it is ironic that conservation at one time, Gifford Pinchot was the governor, Republican governor of Pennsylvania, had argued this with successfully with Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, and that is, you can't have modern capitalist development, whether you want to call it market, mixed market, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it, socialist, but even a free market, you can't have it without conservation. Mm-hmm. And the more development and the more population you have, if you don't invest more and more every year in conservation, you end up in this kind of deficit, small examples all around that we've been talking about here, which I think don't have the complete origin in lack of conservation. But since we're no longer a bipartisan supporting community of conservation, we think we can get something for nothing, and I think this Las Vegas mentality has to end sometime.
It's another one of these disbalances that we keep adding in, you know? A system that's just dysfunctional, irrational, and we know we're not, this is not going to work out. Again, hard clean word to use here.
History repeats itself, or it rhymes.
Oh, yeah, well, it's very, like Easter Island, you know.
After me, the deluge, isn't that?
Lemmings, apparently, don't jump off cliffs. That was like some Disney fabrication in the 50s. But humans do.
You know? Anyway,
folks. If a great human does it before they do.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank our guest, Joseph Seri, Dr. Joseph Seri, and of course,
we'll have to bring him in here again.
Our resident host of our show, Punkonomics, Dr. Benny Ballack, and again, from my side, Jesse Valesa. Thank you, everybody, for listening. You have been listening to Punkonomics here on WPRK 91.5, Winter Park, and we'll leave you with our theme song.
See you next week.